Donald Trump makes his choice.
It is therefore my honor to nominate Ohio Senator J.D. Vance for the office of Vice President of the United States of America.
However, Trump's choice has Kyiv worried.
Ukrainians know J.D. Vance as a staunch critic of support for Ukraine in Congress. Experts in Ukraine consider Vance's vice presidency to be an alarming signal not only for Kyiv, but also for Europe.
And later, foreign policy at the RNC, Israel-Hamas peace talks continue, and Iran weighs in on the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Today is Tuesday, July 16th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Our top story today is, again, American politics and the race for the White House. The weekend assassination attempt on Donald Trump has silenced much of the political chatter over President Joe Biden's political future. But as Trump charged forward on Monday, appearing at the Republican National Convention and naming his VP pick, the Biden administration canceled a Monday event and prepared for a Tuesday campaign stop at this uncertain stage in the presidential race. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
The stark differences between the two main presidential campaigns were further illuminated Monday, with heated, energetic scenes.
You don't like Trump? So what? We don't care.
As Republicans nominated Donald Trump at their convention in Milwaukee.
Greatest president that's ever lived, and that's Donald J. Trump.
And from the Democrat-run White House, cool reserve from President Joe Biden, who has urged the nation to bring down the temperature on political rhetoric after the shocking weekend assassination attempt on Trump. On Monday, he told NBC's Lester Holt that he still deeply disagrees with Trump and with the inflammatory and vicious way Trump and his base communicate grievances, and asked whether he thought the shooting would change the trajectory of the presidential race.
I don't know, and you don't know either.
But it seems to have resolved the last political cliffhanger, the national debate over whether Biden's poor debate performance meant he should step aside. Jim Kessler is executive vice president for think tank Third Way.
I expect that Joe Biden has weathered this storm, and this question about whether he should drop out is mostly in the rearview mirror, but he needs to perform well.
Trump on Monday made his post-shooting debut to a thunderous reception and a crowd that shouted, fight, fight, fight. Biden also criticized Trump in the interview.
Look, I'm not the guy that said, I want to be a dictator on day one. I'm not the guy that refused to accept the outcome of the election. I'm not the guy who said that won't accept the outcome of this election.
Both men have called for unity in the wake of Trump's shooting. But analysts say that word may not mean what you think it means. John Geer is a distinguished professor of political science at Vanderbilt University.
They're both calling for unity, but I think their differences in the kind of concept are fundamental. And that's where I think the problem is going to break down. And so they're calling for it. But in fact, it may well be partisanship in disguise.
So what happens now as these two grandfathers sprint to the end of a contest so grueling, so bitter, so emotionally charged, and so consequential, and yet with such a tiny margin of victory? I don't know. And neither do you. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
Donald Trump named Ohio Senator J.D. Vance to be on the Republican ticket with him.
It is therefore my honor to nominate Ohio Senator J.D. Vance for the office of Vice President of the United States of America!
Vance was once a prominent critic of Trump, even calling him America's Hitler. However, Vance has gone on to become a fervent supporter of Trump and his right-wing populist movement, including echoing false claims that the 2020 election was somehow stolen from Trump and that President Biden and his son Hunter Biden are involved in corruption and criminal activity. Vance will turn 40 next month. Republicans are hoping that he'll help with outreach to younger, undecided voters. While the attempted assassination of Donald Trump and the choice of J.D. Vance may be topping the headlines as the Republican National Convention got started on Monday, America's foreign policy under a new president is perhaps more important to people outside the United States. While there were no specific policy proposals to come out of Monday's convention speeches, Donald Trump and J.D. Vance each have long records we can look at, and the Republican Party released its official platform last week, so we have a decent idea of what the foreign policy of a Trump-Vance administration might look like. Helping me sort through it all is Allison McManus, the Managing Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress Action Fund.
I think what we can expect from a Trump-Vance foreign policy would be what I would call a militarized isolationism. We've seen a lot of efforts to frame foreign policy, Trump's first administration's foreign policy agenda, as "quote unquote peace through strength," but really what we've seen, both in terms of the first Trump administration, but even more so, I would say the statements that Trump and certainly Vance have made on the campaign trail, really have to do with building up our military, building up the defense budget, while also going after alliances, treaties, cutting other critical national security programs like development, global health, climate. So really this sort of follows the isolationist approach that we've seen them take also when it comes to, building walls around our borders, of kind of walling off territory, building up defense through the military, while also retrenching the United States from more diplomatic or development means of engaging with the rest of the world.
And it might seem like a naive question. I'm sort of playing devil's advocate here, but so what? For somebody living in America, why is this a problem? For people who aren't living in America, why is this a problem?
Well, it's certainly a problem both for people living in the United States and certainly for people living abroad. Again, if we think about the greatest threats to our national security, these are threats of global public health crises. I mean, this we learned, the hard way when it came to the COVID-19 pandemic. These are threats of climate change. So I would argue that to solve those problems, just building more bombs aren't necessarily going to be able to do it. You can't bomb a pandemic. Really will take cooperation, particularly cooperation with allies, and also at times cooperation with those countries that we may not agree with. So that's one, is that the threats that we're facing are global. They affect Americans like they affect folks all over the world. Two, when it comes to, simply where taxpayer dollars are spent, dollars that are spent in the defense industrial base don't tend to be as productive for the economy.
So looking ahead to what a Republican foreign policy might look like, and of course, a Republican State Department and foreign policy apparatus, there is a handbook, essentially, a plan, Project 2025, put out by the Heritage Foundation, a right-leaning conservative think tank, basically outlining plans for a Republican administration to take that would achieve these conservative goals. What does Project 2025 say about a future Republican foreign policy?
So there's a few things that we can see in Project 2025. I mean, one is really dialing up the conflict, I would say, with China. So this is something that former President Trump has talked a lot about. We've seen President Biden over the last 4 years taking a more, I would say, nuanced approach. We've seen some areas of dialogue, particularly around climate change, as we saw a meeting in Sunnylands last year. But also continued, competition, economic competition, and then certainly some concerns around aggression, military aggression from China. I think if we look at what's in Project 2025, really we see, no areas of potential cooperation, no real thinking about what does it take for the United States to compete with China by investing in the United States, and much more of a focus on really dialing up the sort of conflict with China. So that's one area that I would say really comes through in the Project 2025 agenda. The other area that I think is really important to pay attention to is the replacing, you know, career, foreign service, civil service employees with regime loyalists. There is no mincing of words in Project 2025 about the future Trump administration's desire to remove any who have expressed dissent to the president's policies, removing them and replacing them with, loyalists.
Disturbing as that is, what does that have to do with foreign policy?
Well, what that would have to do with foreign policy would be quashing any kind of dissent or any kind of questioning. So we've seen over the last 9 months, particularly as the United States has supported Israel in its war in Gaza, a lot of varied positions from those who may be, for instance, in the State Department. We've heard a lot about the use of dissent channels for diplomats or for civil service officers to be able to raise concerns about the direction of policy. We wouldn't see any of this. I think this would really be completely clamped down on in a Trump administration, because there would be this threat of, you know, being removed if you say anything that might call into question the president's policies.
Allison McManus is Managing Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Ms. McManus, thanks for your time today. Thanks for your insight.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The latest from Kyiv, including what Ukrainians think of J.D. Vance, coming up. But first, 3 days after the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump, Iran's Islamist rulers have not commented publicly on what happened to the man they've long seen as a nemesis. The former president used his time in office to pursue a policy of maximum pressure on Iran to stop its perceived malign behaviors and to carry out the 2020 assassination of Iran's top military commander, Qasem Soleimani. While Iran's ruling clerics have been silent, their state media have published the main facts of the assassination attempt, as well as photos of the aftermath, including the bloodied Trump defiantly raising his fist. Shahram Koldi is an Iranian-Canadian teacher of Middle East history at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. My colleague Michael Lippin spoke with him on Monday about why Iran would allow its state media to publish images of the former president adopting what many Americans see as a triumphant stance in the face of danger.
What they are trying to do, and they especially do this for their support base, like those 1-3 million Basijis, IRGC, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, hardcore hardliner, people who are willing to kill and die to keep this regime in power. They don't see what you see as positive. They see the weakness. They see division in the midst of the American masses. They see the kind of fractures in the United States democratic system. And they actually use those pictures in order to reinforce this propaganda trope that, look, this is just the facade of democracy. What is really happening is that there is something more sinister happening behind the scenes. And who knows, maybe the Democrats were behind it and they ordered Trump's killing, or they would even come up with something more, I would say, conspiracy-minded, that saying that maybe the world Zionist leaders were trying to make sure that Trump has to follow whatever they are saying, and maybe there was some sort of a division amongst them behind the scenes. You should not be surprised to see such scenarios would be replicated by the Iranian regime's propaganda machine in the next few weeks. This is just really barely 48 hours. And even though they have such a massive propaganda machine, churning out all these stories like anything else, even for such a heavily equipped and very well manned, I would say, machinery like the propaganda machinery of the Islamic Republic. It still takes time, but they are going to come out, mark my words. They have done that in many, many different occasions.
So if Trump is elected in November and comes back to the presidency, given his very tough record on Iran when he was president the first time, wouldn't that give the Iranian leaders some pause? Might they even be a little more fearful now that it looks like the former president has gotten a boost in his election prospects?
They are, and I would say what I would characterize as an atypical restraint by the Iranian officials. The Iranian officials are generally very quick to react and make all sorts of preposterous statements on such occasions.
But they didn't this time.
No, they didn't this time. And I think we have to, as you kindly mentioned and you have observed very rightly, they are on their toes right now. Even though I have it on good authority that the Chinese and the Russians have guaranteed them that if President Trump is reelected, they would be making sure that they would protect the Islamic Republic's interests in their whatever negotiations they are going to have with President Trump. So I think the Islamic Republic is right now engaged in some sort of unusual two-dimensional chess because of its increased relations, especially thanks to, and I say this rather sarcastically, unfortunately, thanks to President Biden's failure to stop Iranian oil being exported to China and to do anything concretely to stop the Iranian assistance to Russia in Russia's war effort and invasion of Ukraine. The Islamic Republic is emboldened on the one hand, and it feels that it is stronger. But on the other hand, the prospect of undergoing the massive pressure campaign that President Trump leveled upon the Islamic Republic brought down its oil production and export, massively intercepted their tankers. I think they are erring right now on the side of caution, but this is partly perhaps because the Chinese and Russian whispers have advised them to do so. I don't attribute it to their impeccable wisdom. And impeccable wisdom, you have to put in quotation marks in this regard.
That's VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with Shahram Koldi of the University of Waterloo in Ontario. Meanwhile, in Europe, J.D. Vance opposed American aid to Kyiv and once said he doesn't care about Ukraine. So what has the reaction been to his nomination for vice president? For that and more, we turn to our correspondent in Kyiv, Anna Chernikova, for the details.
Trump's nomination of J.D. Vance as his vice president in the American elections greatly upset many Ukrainians, especially those who follow the political life of the United States. Ukrainians know J.D. Vance as a staunch critic of support for Ukraine in Congress. Experts in Ukraine consider Vance's vice presidency to be an alarming signal not only for Kyiv but also for Europe, because it confirms that America may become more isolationist if the Republicans come to power. In April, when the U.S. Congress was deciding the fate of a multi-billion dollar package of military aid to Kyiv, Vance wrote a column in the New York Times, the essence of which boils down to a simple thesis. Nobody, least of all the USA, has the resources to win Ukraine in the war against Russia. So what's the point to help Ukraine? Vance also opposes Ukraine's membership in NATO and believes that Kyiv should make significant territorial concessions because this is the only way out of the conflict. At the Munich Security Conference in February, Vance suggested that a new Republican administration might work with Putin. In terms of Ukraine, Vance said that the USA does not have enough capabilities to satisfy all the Ukrainians' needs for weapons. And in general, how long will this still last? How much will it all cost? Vance refused the opportunity to meet with the Ukrainian delegation in Munich because, according to him, he didn't think he would learn anything new. An anonymous high-ranking EU official summed up Vance's candidacy briefly in an interview with Politico as a disaster, and not only for Ukraine, but also for the European Union. Meanwhile, the European Union is considering various options for punishment for Hungary due to an uncoordinated visit of Viktor Orban to Russia. Because of Orban's trip to Russia, the head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, cancelled the visit of the Board of Commissioners to Hungary and adjusted the level of representation at the meetings under the Hungarian presidency. This means the European commissioners will not attend informal meetings organized by the Hungarian presidency. A spokesperson for the European Commission said that this decision was made in the light of the latest events related to the beginning of Hungary's presidency. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met two Israeli officials on Monday and discussed ongoing talks toward a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. National Security Advisor Tzachi Hangvi and Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs Ron Dermer confirmed that Israel is still committed to reaching a deal under terms laid out by President Biden on May 31st. Here's State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
I will tell you what we heard directly from two senior advisors to Prime Minister Netanyahu today, and that is that Israel is still committed to reaching a ceasefire, that Israel wants to reach a ceasefire. Obviously, they want to protect their interests. We understand that as part of the negotiating process, but they do want to reach a ceasefire and are committed to these negotiations. As I said, there are a few remaining sticking points, and we're working to try and resolve those.
Israel struck the southern and central Gaza Strip on Monday to put more pressure on Hamas. This follows a weekend strike targeting the militant group's leadership, which killed scores of Palestinian civilians who had sought shelter in a makeshift camp. Again, Matthew Miller.
So one of the things the secretary did when he met with Ron Dermer and the National Security Advisor Hanegbi earlier today was to express our serious concern about the recent civilian casualties in Gaza. As I've noted before, we have seen civilian casualties come down from the high points of the conflict and even from where they were, say, 6 weeks, 2 months ago, but they still remain unacceptably high.
2 days after the Israeli strike turned a crowded swath of Mawasi near the Mediterranean coast into a charred wasteland littered with burning cars and mangled bodies, displaced survivors say they have no idea where they should go next. Police in Kenya fired tear gas in central Nairobi on Tuesday to disperse protesters aiming to keep pressure on President William Ruto after he made a series of concessions to the demonstrators' demands. This unnamed protester was among them.
Until we started demonstrating the streets, that's now nowadays we're having president in this country. We're having our president in this country. Ruto is very much incompetent. He has no leadership skills. He just wanted the title to be the president of this country. After sending, we know, like, the guy is a puppet to IMF. That is it. Whatever he's doing from IMF. He's not leading this country at all. He's not leading this country at all.
Protests spread to Kitengela near Nairobi, as well as to Mombasa on the coast. Demonstrations were originally sparked by proposed tax increases and allegations of government corruption. And in nearby Rwanda, results from Monday's election are in, and as expected, incumbent Paul Kagame won an overwhelming victory. And that's going to wrap it up for us today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.